Hi, I'm Jim Tavenin. Welcome to Spokane Public Radio's New Releases program. Recently, I had the great pleasure of talking with Laura St. John, Canadian-born violinist who has an earned reputation as a musical maverick. She has a new album out that continues that reputation strongly. It's called Key of A, and it features two great pieces in the Key of A, the Kreutzer Sonata by Ludwig van Beethoven and the Sonata by César Franck for violin and piano. Her collaborator on the album, which is, by the way, on her own and Caligon label, is Matt Herskovitz. Here's our conversation. Truly a delight to meet you. I really love and admire your work, and especially this last album, Key of A, that we'll be delving into today. It's a wonderful presentation. So congratulations on the album. You grew up in a musical family. Your mom was a music teacher, and you write that you started violin at age 2. Would that have been like an eighth size instrument, or how did that work for you?
Actually, at 2.5, I started, I think, and I believe it was a 32nd size.
Oh my!
It's so tiny, and you know, honestly, it cannot have sounded good. Yeah, but my brother and I, just sort of the minute we got the instruments, we just kind of took off and did a lot of things very, very young. I played my first concerto when I was 4. I know it's so ridiculous. And, you know, European debut at 9. And it's preposterous when I even say it. I mean, what? I'm kind of like, I can't believe that was me. It's crazy.
Well, obviously you took to the instrument, to put it mildly. And in those first years especially, were there pieces that you heard that kind of fired your imagination? And also, were there people who you met in your early years that really directed you ultimately to where you are now?
Well, interestingly, we had I grew up in a, you know, not disastrously poor, but not a wealthy family. And we only had a couple of records. And I've noticed that those records have sort of stayed with me my whole life. We had the Chicago Symphony Rite of Spring, for example, and an anthology of the great symphonies. So, of course, one of them was Beethoven 9, and there was Tchaikovsky 5. And, you know, when I hear those, there is something somehow more, it's more intrinsic than others, because we would just listen to them all the time. And, of course, we had, I'm Canadian, so we had the CBC. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Glenn Gould was a huge feature all the time. So I kind of grew up with his toccatas and the first Goldberg, and then the second one when it came out in 82, I think. And, you know, so that was sort of a huge presence in my growing up and listening life.
Thinking about Glenn Gould for just a second, is there a way in which his individuality and his unique approach to the music of Bach informed you as a performer down the road?
Yeah, it certainly did with the playing of the solo Bach partitas and sonatas. He is incredible at how he manages to carry voices, like basically make it horizontal playing as opposed to vertical. And I spent years trying to achieve that same thing. On a violin, it's just physically not the same kind of possibility as on a keyboard, but of trying to achieve that horizontal, like the continuation of the lines, the way that he did. I don't know if you've ever heard his Moscow concert. It's a bootleg, but he starts the Art of the Fugue, and he starts it so slowly that you just think to yourself, and it's live, it's before he started not playing live, you think to yourself, there's no way he could keep this going at this tempo. It's way too slow. And yet he does. And every voice, you could follow every single voice, and it never loses any kind of continuity. And to do that on a keyboard, to do that live, I mean, that's my single favorite track ever recorded is the bootleg Concert of Moscow by Glenn Gould. And yeah, and I mean, that's something that, especially on the violin, it's so easy to just like smash through chords and play vertically and not pay any attention to the voicing and to the lines. And so definitely I have learned a lot from him over the years.
Glenn Gould, of course, it popped into my mind the famous occasion when he was doing Brahms with the New York Phil, and Leonard Bernstein made his famous disclaimer.
That's great. Yeah, I mean, his Brahms one is kind of, it's almost like he's making fun of Brahms, actually. But there are some interesting ideas, and nobody plays it like that. So,
it's a monument. It is its own monument. You went on to do what was for you a truly memorable, or spend some memorable time in the Soviet Union in its death throes. What was that like, and how did it inform your playing, and maybe even unto what we hear in Kiev A?
Well, it was the year before the storm, I guess you could say, 88 to 89, that I was there. I had just turned 17 years old. So once again, I kind of, you know, I mean, I look back at this and I go, oh my God, is that me? That's crazy. Like, how did, if I had a 17-year-old kid who was about to go to the Soviet Union, I'd probably say, no way, you're mad. but I did. I was on an exchange program. And I think it was before that I had been basically just in, well, not entirely, but in a practice room. I mean, I was at the Curtis Institute from when I was 13, and that's basically the only people you meet are musicians, and all you talk about is music. And I knew very little about life, and so that was certainly something I learned that year in Moscow, and a language. I came from a bilingual background, and also, you know, I had a musical ear, and I was 17, and it was total immersion. So I learned very quickly to speak, and I mean that kind of an experience, and just meeting so many people from so many places up to that point I had never heard of, because I was in the conservatory residence. So of course all the foreigners, including you know, people from the Soviet areas, like I'd never heard of Uzbekistan before, or Tajikistan, and all these interesting sort of amazing sounding places, and just meeting all those people and learning language and learning the songs and traveling to Kazakhstan and to Georgia and Armenia. And I mean, it was, I think that did a lot more for me than like 80 more years of some sort of music college would have done.
And that's where you met first the music of the Romani people?
Yeah, a good friend of mine was from Sochi. She was from a Romani family. And she used to just come, like, we all had sort of really crappy but upright pianos in our rooms. And so she would just come by and just start playing the piano and start singing, and you know, it was just so much fun. And I learned a lot of songs and a lot of different from a lot of different cultures when I was there.
I always have to ask this with any musician who is either practicing in two different worlds, say in jazz and classical, or some sort of pop or rock music with along with art music. To what degree does your background with this essential folk music inform your performance of, say, Beethoven?
I mean, I find the difference between, the only real difference between folk music and I guess we could call it art music, the great sonatas of say Beethoven, are it's the music of many and the music of one. But he was definitely influenced. There's no way that he hadn't heard like a whole bunch of folk songs growing up, probably in his Bavarian beer hall, or you know, in a Viennese restaurant, in a Kafana music. I mean, there would have been all sorts of folk stuff that he would have been influenced by himself. And I think that's evident in especially all of the classical composers. Even Bach himself, you know, by the time he wrote his Gigue and Courantes and these dances, they were no longer actually dances, but he was influenced by folk music that created those dances in his secular music. So I don't really find that it's that far away from each other. And you know, with the Shiksa album, we concentrated a lot on Gypsy or Romani and Jewish music because those are two cultures in which the violin is huge, and that's because they're both very peripatetic. You can't be picking up your giant 9-foot Steinway Grand when you have to, you know, decamp and go somewhere else because of, you know, I mean, they had to be quick at moving for centuries upon centuries, both of them. And so they have a lot in common with each other instrumentally and also scale wise. And the violin ended up being basically the centerpiece of Gypsy bands and also Jewish music, klezmer. And so I just thought that was a very interesting culture that we should, you know, all violinists should know about, and especially Gypsy violinists. I mean, they've influenced so many composers over the years, and I mean, so much violin music is basically comes from, I think, from composers being jealous that they couldn't just make that up on the spot.
So let's move on. Key of A, your new album, which is on your own label, and Caligon, if I say that correctly.
Perfect.
And we could, if we have time, we can delve into that just a little bit. But let's focus on the album right now. Your partner on this is the pianist Matt Herskovitz. And how long have you and he been working together?
Over 10 years at this point. We've done a lot of different projects because he's known as a jazz pianist more than classical. So we collaborated on his Jerusalem Trilogy album, and then we did the Shiksa album, and this is actually our first standard repertoire album together, if you will.
And how did the choice of rep come, how did that happen?
Well, these are, arguably, for violin and piano, these are the two pinnacles of their respective eras, of the classical being the Beethoven, and romantic being the Franck. Because, you know, Beethoven, it's an opus 49, so he wasn't quite at his, you know how people always say, oh, he drove the classical into the romantic era, but yeah, he was still pretty young at this point. And not quite there yet. So also, as you may or may not know, in classical music, there's a lot of tradition for tradition's sake. And I'm not a huge fan of that. And it was great to be working on these incredibly standard, famous violin piano pieces with a pianist who had never played them before. And so he was coming at it with, first of all, with a very different idea and ear, because he does every single style imaginable, and also without any of these preconceptions. And so we were able to sort of start from scratch and just really make it our own. And I also find that we're sort of very evenly matched, as we're both quite extreme people. And these sonatas are also very, very well matched between violin and piano. They're both written for violinists and by keyboard players. And so they have a lot in common with each other. But it just, you know, if anybody ever said, oh, who's your accompanist for this pieces, I would be like, are you kidding me? You've got to call him a pianist, you know, because it's so equal. And I mean, you find some of Beethoven's other sonatas, actually, you know, he wrote sonatas for piano and violin. That's how he titled them in the manuscript. And a lot of them kind of are, you know, the violin is just kind of doing its own silly little thing here and there, while the piano has like 10 million notes. Not in the case of the Kreutzer. He really wrote this for Bridgetower, who was his friend at the time, and he performed it with him. And by all accounts, the guy was a complete maniac, and they had a falling out, which is why it's called the Kreutzer Sonata and not the Bridgetower.
And Kreutzer, of course, was not a big fan of it, but his name is immortalized through it.
I know, he hated it. He didn't like it at all. And then Tolstoy immortalized it even more. So.
And What impresses me about your playing in this and the playing of you in the plural, both you and Matt Herskovitz, is there's a wonderful fluidity. Of course, there's wonderful communication that you can sense in listening to it. But also, there's a wonderful fluidity of the line and a wonderful flexibility of time. Is that something, well, to what degree is that something that you think through, and to what degree is it something that just happens as you are rehearsing the piece?
I think it's more that it just happens. Both of us are quite spontaneous, and we're not really sure how or why, but somehow, I mean, a lot of times I'll just decide to do something completely different. Like, oh, I think I'm going to do a retard here instead of a cello rondo. And he somehow knows. Mm-hmm. Like, it's weird. And so we're able to sort of keep each other on each other's toes, but also it's never the same twice.
Mm-hmm.
Which is, I guess, kind of an element from jazz and gypsy and improv. But it certainly keeps me interested in playing this repertoire over and over.
Right. There tends to be a set-in-stone quality to a lot of performances that you mm-hmm. could superimpose one on the other, and it's like all the lines would match up. But I,
yeah.
As you say, I doubt that would happen with you and Matt Herskovitz.
No.
If you go through a half a dozen performances of the same thing, there'd be all kinds of coloring outside the lines that would happen between the two.
I've noticed sometimes when we, like, if I have a couple of recordings, there's actually a 2 or 3 minute difference between one performance and the other. Like, we'll just decide to take off at some point, and then other times it's like, you know, let's try this a little slower without even saying it, but just kind of doing it. So it's interesting.
Well, I would ask if you have performances in different places of the repertory from this, but obviously not for the foreseeable future. You were scheduled to do one in Harlem on the 20th of April, which sounds like the Crypt Sessions. How long have they been in existence?
A couple of years, actually. They're ridiculously popular. They sell out in 30 seconds. You know, it's almost like a pop concert.
Now, where is the Harlem Crypt?
It's under, I forget the name of the church, Saint someone, and you go sort of down these stairs, and the crypt itself is very beautiful, like vaulted ceilings, and mm-hmm. I mean it's a somber but quite incredible space, actually. Yeah. And I mean, it's not like there are kind of coffins or anything around. It's
right.
Empty.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
But yeah, and the acoustics are quite something.
Oh, good.
Very church,
good.
Church-like, yeah.
Well, before we have to part here, I have to ask about the cover art on this album. It is, at the very least, arresting. It's not something, well, it's something that you say, oh, I see the letter A. Then you take a much closer look and you go, oh my. There are two violin bows. And the implement that is in the middle is a scimitar?
It's actually a Damascus dagger.
Okay, all right. It's from that area of the world, at any rate.
It's actually from Tolstoy, in his Kreutzer Sonata, used the Damascus dagger for the climax of his novella. And
okay.
Yeah, so that's where that comes from. And then the wedding ring is from also the Kreutzer Sonata, the Tolstoy. And the idea that the two were both written for violinists is the rest of the A.
One last question about it.
Sure.
The little Chrysler piece at the end, which is just a stroke of genius. It's like dessert has been included in this very hearty meal, the Schön Rosmarin. How did that come about?
Actually, we were just having fun in the studio, because we were going to do a sort of a live performance of what we had recorded at WGBH in Boston. And I said, well, let's add this and let's add that. And then we just sort of decided, oh yeah, let's do Schön Rosmarin. And somehow we ended up just kind of sticking in a little jazz waltz near the end of it. And I don't know, it just, it was very sweet. And Kreisler is actually part of the connection violinistically between these two sonatas. A student of Kreutzer was the teacher of Kreisler, who was the teacher of Isai, whom the Franck was written for. You know,
the connections are amazing.
there is an unbroken line between the two of them over close to 100 years. It was sort of a little desserty thing that we just decided to include.
Yeah, we're all happy for that, and happy for you with your new album, Key of A. Laura St. John, we wish you all the best, and I hope that performances will start soon for you.
And that me too.
Maybe, yeah, I can imagine, and I hope one of these days that we can see you in person.
That'd be great. Well, thank you.
The album is called Key of A, featuring violinist Laura St. John and pianist Matt Herskovitz. It's newly out on the Ancaligon label, and it's been our pleasure to bring you the sounds of Laura St. John and just a bit from the album as well. I'm Jim Tevenin. Thanks so much for listening to Spokane Public Radio's New Releases.